had other other battles, but largely they went pretty clear sailing through the rest of France and up into Belgium, and then they had some bad shows in Holland, actually, at the end. But I guess the history would prove that most of the fighting that our regiment actually did was in the first 3 months of the key thing was the landing, of course, which was very successful. Mm-hmm. And I'm not taking away from anything we've done later on, because the infantry really carried the show. We supported them all the way up. So,
Can you talk a bit about the daily life that you went through?
You mean in France or in Britain?
In France, first of all, but in Britain as well. The kind of
In Britain, just to go back, because it's interesting. Remember, we were there from October 41 till June 44, and we didn't technically have a shot fired at us in anger. And it got pretty frustration built very quickly. After 2.5 years of being away, we weren't sent home every 6 months on rotation. Most of us that went over in 41 were still there in 44, except for sickness, casualties, or whatever, health. So some of us got bored. I had I call it the privilege. I was called up in the spring of 42. We were in the south of England, and I was called to headquarters and said I was to take a group of three tanks from our regiment up. All they told me was to report to a map reference. Everything was top secret, of course, and I was to pick up some other tanks and then proceed to another map reference and report there. So I proceeded along, and I took my troop and of Sherman's, this tank, and at the point of map reference I met up with three British tanks, and so they joined up and went further, and we joined up with Polish, I guess, I forget, anyway, another, and the whole group of us proceeded, and where we ended up was a place called Gatwick, which you may recognize. It was an airport or RAF station of Nissen huts and so on. It was they were fighter planes, anyway. Can't remember the type of plane they had. They were British. And the idea is it was the start of combined operations, and the history had been that in the desert, the British and Americans had lost a lot of their tanks because of a lack of recognition from the Air Force of whether they were good guys or bad guys. So our job went up, and we'd put signals on the back of our tanks, or paint things, or flags, so that the Air Force would recognize what a Sherman tank is from a Churchill tank, from a German tank, or whatever else. And we were also practicing ground-to-air communications again to see how good our wireless was working. So this was just an assignment for a combined operation, which broke the boredom. And our job would be go during the night and then go to a given map reference and disguise our tanks with netting and so on, or branches. And then the job of the Air Force in the morning was to find us, identify where we were, and then identify the kind of tank and so on. And this went on for some couple of weeks or more. And it was very interesting because we would be finished our job by 4 noon every day. And I learned to fly. The young Brits took me up in a training plane and taught me how to fly, basically. And when one day they had an old ferry battle, which was an old British bomber of the early 30s, which they used just for transportation. And on one occasion they said, "Look, what are you doing this afternoon? Would you like to come over for a ride over to Wales?" I said, "Sure." So I went in this ferry battle, which, and they were taking some pilots over to do training, shooting drogues. They had a plane towing a drogue, and they were practicing their drogue fighting. But I was just here on a junket. Anyway, the next day, the same thing happened. In the afternoon, they said, would you like to go up to Glasgow? This fellow was flying up again, the ferry battle. We've got to pick up some pilots. He was going up to pick up. Oh, no, he was rather delivering some pilots who were picking up planes coming into Glasgow. So myself and another chap, Andy Fife, who was in my regiment, had been with me. And so we flew to Glasgow, and we landed there in the early, in the middle of the afternoon, I guess. And we filled up with gas, and it was a big single-engine plane, a Rolls-Royce engine bomber. And when we landed, I looked up, and from the engine was something running out, dripping out. Said to the pilot, what's that? Oh, he said, that's all right, that's a glycol, it's a coolant, but don't worry about it. So I didn't worry about it. Anyway, we took off, and just the pilot up in the front, and the other officer, myself, in the rear, back with a bubble, you can see out. And we were at about 5,000 feet going across, and we could see, we started Glasgow, we were going across to the east coast. We could see Edinburgh up there, and we could see the North Sea over here. And all of a sudden, the engine burst on fire. Flames came out, black smoke. The pilot looked around, and we didn't have any radio, but he could see us through the, and he went like this, we're going down, which was obvious. We didn't have any parachutes, he did. They didn't have any for us, although we shouldn't have been in the plane without them. Anyway, we went down, and he was very good. He's a young fellow, he was 18. Jerry Green, his name was. And we came in for a land. We were right on the border, a little village called Berwick-on-Tweed, which is right on the border of England and Scotland. And the country is hilly. They call it mountains, but it's what we call hilly country. So the pilot looked for a field he could land in. And he came in, and we were looking out. Andy and I were looking out this bubble. And as we were coming in, we were coming right at a tree, and we thought, anyway, the pilot lifted his wing to miss the tree, which he did, but in the meantime, this wing hit the ground, and we cartwheeled, and this is what saved us. It broke both wings off, which were full of petrol, broke the engine off, and what was left, the fuselage, we were in it. We were thrown forward through a perspex wall. We landed up in the bomb hatch. The pilot was still strapped in. The engine was completely severed off and was blazing in the field away. We didn't know this later, of course, because we were out cold. Anyway, I don't know how long we were in the field, but some farmers had seen the plane coming down. So the first I heard, I woke up and somebody saying, hey, there's another dead one in here. That was me. So they chopped open with an axe the side of the plane, and they pulled myself and my friend Andy out, and they took the pilot, who was still strapped to a seat, took him out. And he was the worst. He had a broken leg and other serious injuries. I got off the leg. I had a broken arm and collarbone and ribs and so on. Anyway, they took us back into Berwick-on-Tweed. A little civilian hospital, very nice. And we were the first real war casualty they had seen. And did we ever get well looked after? We were there for, I guess till the middle of August. We were there for about 2 months until we were well enough to travel. And we were sent down to south of England to Bramshott, which was the Canadian Red Cross hospital. Military hospital, and we were there, and I remember it well because we landed on the 18th. We arrived there on the 18th of August, and the next day was the 19th of August, which was my birthday. That was my 1942. I was 23, I guess. Yeah, born in 1919. Yeah, I was 23. Anyway. It was a momentous day. Do you remember what happened on the 19th of August?
42?
42?
No.
That was Dieppe. You heard of Dieppe?
Of course, yeah.
Well, yeah. We were in Bramshaw. Well, of course, none of us knew about Dieppe until first we heard was when they were bringing the casualties back. And at that time, we were what they call walking wounded, and we were able to help working with the orderlies and cleaning up these poor kids. And we did that for 24 hours, and then they needed our beds. So we were shipped off to Garland, which was Garfield Weston's estate in England, and he had to turn it over to the Canadian Army as a R&R for the Canadian officers. So the reason I mention this, you say, what was like in life in England? I won't give you all the details, but went out with the Royal Navy on a Hunt-class destroyer for 2 weeks, and believe me, that was an experience I'll never forget, and I had greatest respect for the British Navy, just living on a destroyer for 2 weeks. We sailed up to from Rosyth, which is up north of Edinburgh, up to Scapa Flow, and picked up a convoy and then brought it back down to London and so on. But that took up 3 weeks of my time, shall we say. And a lot of our boys went on courses, you know, upgrading their skills in machine, whatever their skills. Remember, we not only had be skilled in gunnery, wireless, mechanics, and then map reading, logistics, and all the rest of it. So we were on constantly on a learning curve. Do I ever drive a tank? Yes, I did once or twice, but in those days it was all strictly manual. If you wanted to turn, you pull this and that. Now it's all computerized, and in fact, just to jump ahead, when I was I was lieutenant governor here for some years, and I was down in visiting down the Maritimes, and the Canadian Army were there with their Leopard tanks. They were state of the art. This is in the early 80s. And they had, knowing I was been in the tanks, they asked me if I'd like to drive a Leopard tank. Well, I had trouble just climbing up to get into it, let alone... Anyway, they let me drive it. And, of course, it was just like driving a new Cadillac. It was all power, steering, power, brake, power, this and so on. But going back, they look exactly the same as this, but they're entirely different, of course. And at that point, the Leopard was obsolete also, by the way. But... Now back to life in England. We live very well. In fact, our food compared to the Brits was far superior. Of course, the people at home were very good Red Cross parcels. I have great respect for the Red Cross. We couldn't have won the war without the Red Cross or the women. The other thing that impressed me was the women of Britain, and I don't think they've been given full credit for their contribution. I mean, if they weren't in the land army, they were working in a munitions factory or manning the guns in Hyde Park in London or driving a transport truck. My wife came over in the Red Cross, Canadian Red Cross, volunteer, no pay, pick up $5 a month to do the laundry, or £1 a month. And she was a cook down in Red Cross Officers Club number 3. And out in the basement, and she cooked for 150 officers 3 meals a day, and no meal, and there were, I guess, maybe 800 or 1,000 Red Cross Canadian women went over, but it was all the women of Britain, you know, were part of the war effort, and we were very fortunate. Of course, nobody in Canada really was directly affected, indirectly, yes, by casualties and other things, but now. Life in France, of course, entirely different. When I came out of France, and remember, I'd only been there 3 months. I don't know how many times I'd had my clothes off. You could probably count them on their two hands. And my wife was in England at the time, and she couldn't hardly stand to come near me because of the smell. Literally, I didn't realize it myself. Now, I'd had some showers. A couple of times I changed my clothes, but the smell of death, and that's the only way I can describe it. I think they described it in that picture again, the dead animals and bodies and whatever else permeated the whole atmosphere. You lived with that all the time. And then you lived in the same clothes because you just took off your boots if you felt safe and crawled under your tank. That's where you slept. Now, and that's in my time. Remember, my time was from June to August. Later on, they were in billets, and they'd go into a town and would be billeted. But in my time, we're happy to get back from Pope.
The light there blinks.
Yeah.
When something's okay. Dead, so as long as it's blinking.
Okay, it's on, right?
Yeah.
No, life in well, it obviously changed, I'd say, for the better after the Ferry Gap show, because, I mean, in the next month, our regiment was all the way through France, whereas the first 3 months, we were hung up by Jerry's very stiff resistance, and that's when, except for the Scheldt Estuary, which we did not take part in, that have you had a chance to read many military books? And it's part of your course study?
Not as many as I'd like.
Well, why there, for instance, one called Tug of War by Brigadier, what's his name? He was a classmate of mine at school. He and his wife wrote a book called The Tug of War, which is the story of the British, the Canadian Army on the Scheldt Estuary, and the Battle of the Scheldt. And it was a hell of a nasty show, and they took a lot of the Canadian infantry, took a hell of a beating, but as I say, our regiment wasn't involved in that. So the lifestyle was significantly different, and of course, again, the first 3 months, we were living on hard rations most of the time, which were edible and quite digestible. We had soup in a can, which had a core going down through the middle. Are you familiar with that? You put a match to it and you'd get hot soup. You'd open it up and it had hot soup. It wasn't the best, but it was hot. And also, being in the tanks, we had our own transportation, and we were never without. We had a stop. We had always brew up a pot of tea because we had lots of, to carry, and not lots, but we had enough room to carry a teapot and a couple of cups. Also, we were never without something to drink, because we liberated a lot of German messes, and we always had lots of cognac or wine or whatever. We were still getting our ration of rum, by the way, in those days. They later on cut it out, I understand. But whereas the poor infantry would be around, probably soaking wet in the mud up to their knees, so they'd come around the tanks and we'd give them a cup of hot tea or something, and they were very grateful. But I don't mean to overplay it, because we survived quite well, and of course we survived off the land. We were well supplied with the odd live chicken and or pig or what have you, and so we'd eat well for a couple of days, because they were just, the farmers had probably fled, or and of course a lot of the livestock were killed by the artillery and so on, bombing. So we came across a lot of dead cows and dead horses, and of course Jerry at that point, which a lot of people don't appreciate, was still using horses a lot for towing his artillery and that sort of thing. Although he hit the latest in mobile guns with his tanks, he also had, as I say, he used a lot of horses in for transportation. The English people were very, very good to us. The Canadians, I guess, were pretty hard to live with, because, remember, these were boys 18 to 22, most of them, who had come from mixed backgrounds, all backgrounds, of course, and a lot of them, most of them, got along very well with the English people. Thousands of them got married, as you know, and one of the, I say, difficult sides of my job as adjutant, I was adjutant for some long period, was dealing with the personnel problems. I mean, a mother would come steaming in one day and tell me her daughter Millie was pregnant, and what was I going to do about it? Well, wasn't much I could do about it. Would call up Corporal Smith or whoever was responsible and asked him what his intentions were, and of course they had to have permission of the regiment to get married, and some did and some didn't. Some were already married at home, of course. So the personnel side was a very significant side from the day you landed in England until you actually hit France, because then the whole world changed completely. But there were a lot of young men got the experience they'd never have had anywhere else if they came from a farm in the prairies or some little town up in northern Ontario. And a lot of these lads, of course, got very good training. They became motor mechanics or got into wireless because of their wireless training. A lot of our officers later on were promoted within the ranks. They had been, many of them were a regular force. The initially, when we were in Camp Borden, I joined what was known as the 1st CCR, 1st Canadian Cavalry Regiment Mechanized, and we had one squadron of Hussars from London and one squadron of Royal RCDs, the Royal Canadian Dragoons, who were permanent force but had not been mobilized as such, and one squadron of the Lord Strathcona Horse, which was another permanent force cavalry regiment, but they had not been mobilized, and our regiment, for whatever reason, was a non-permanent NPAM, and they were mobilized before the RCDs or the Strathconas, and they actually, my regiment, before I joined them in Camp Borden, early 1940 in London, were mobilized with horses. No, in 1939 in the fall, and they were to be the cavalry to go over with the 1st Division, which went over, as you know, in October 39. Was it October they went over? Right after, 2 months after the war was declared,
yeah,
the Canadians went over. And we were supposed to be the cavalry. Of course, they didn't take any horses with them, and so we were left at home, and that's when they were shipped to Camp Borden, and we were given, there were motorcycles initially. And my original training in Camp Borden, because I had been in university, engineering, and they came down recruiting engineering students for officer material, and I had been in the COTC, Canadian Officer Training Corps in the universities, which they don't have anymore, and I had been commanding officer of our cadet corps in the school which I went to in Toronto, which was UTS University School. So because of my background, they put one pip on my shoulder and said, "You're now a second lieutenant." Of course, I didn't know my right foot from my left, really. None of us did. So our initial training in Camp Borden was walking along with flags and brooms, making like we had rifles, which we didn't have. We did get some firing with the odd rifle on a range, a target rifle range, and we learned how to drive motorcycles, we learned how to drive trucks, and then we went on courses for gunnery and Petawawa. And the wireless training, we learned how to operate wireless sets. And this was before Brock, you've heard of Brockville, that's the officer's training. Well, in 1942, I guess, they opened up Brockville, which was where that's where all the Army officers were later trained. I was pre-Brockville, so I got my training in Camp Borden, the initial training. And then constantly in Britain, you were always on courses of one kind or another. So it was an interesting lifetime experience. I don't recommend it at all, obviously, and God help us if we ever get into a situation like that again. But it was a great experience, those of us that survived, and we learned a great deal. I wouldn't have traded the experience I got for anything. 5 years, it's a big chunk out of your life as a young man from, I was, I guess, 20 when I joined up. I was 21. I was 21 when I joined up. But And there aren't too many of us left around. I'm 85 now, so you figure it out. So that's the story, and I could go on, but anything else you want to know?
Just quickly, how much was wireless used?
It was used greatly, but one of our biggest problems and one area where they made tremendous advancement is in the communications, because you heard of snafu, situation normal, all fucked up. I mean, snafu was the way it was most of the time due to a breakdown of communications. And if not, I can only speak from the Armored Corps side, because communications was critical. Remember that you're in a tank and the noise is constant. You have earphones on, so your only communication is talking into your microphone. And I had what we call IC, internal. I could talk to my crew by pushing one button. I could talk to my commanding officer with another button and brigade. But more often than not, you try to get brigade and you wouldn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. Or and then the infantry, they had these portable, I can't remember the names, the equipment, but they kept breaking down. If you had a wire of some kind, which they did on occasion, a string of communication wire, that's fine. But you didn't get that in the early days when everything was moving all the time. We were trained, I went to a wireless course, but I couldn't have, if my gunner, the wireless operator was a loader in the tank, and if I had lost my loader, I couldn't have taken his place, because my 2-week wireless course, I wasn't qualified. I was qualified to command a tank, or command a squadron of tanks, because that's what I'd been trained to do, but I couldn't have driven. I knew the basics to drive a tank, but I never drove a tank in action at all. In fact, the only place I was up here with my head out or in, depending on the situation. Mm-hmm. But wireless, to answer your question, was, I think, the key to success or failure. Some of the worst failures were due to wireless or communication breakdown. The other failure was that we were under-equipped. At least our tanks were not in any sense comparable to the German 88 guns and Tiger tanks or Leopard tanks, which was their next one down, but still could outgun us. The infantry, now again I'm speaking from third-hand knowledge, during the in France particularly, had good rifles. They had all the modern rifles and machine guns, Bren guns, Sten guns. But the infantry's main problem was, same as ours, they had very poor reinforcements. And of course that's the case today, which I hate to bring up, but we are in a terrible state. Our military today, particularly the Army, the Navy have their 6 new frigates, and the Air Force has their F-18s, which are, well, they're technically obsolete, but they're still first line. The Army have, they've got tanks, the Leopard tank was obsolete 20 years ago, but they still have them, but that's all we've got. You've read about the problems with our Jeeps, or whatever they were called, the ones that blew up. And the message just doesn't seem to get through to Ottawa that we shouldn't be sending these boys over to Afghanistan or any part of the world. Now they're sending them to Haiti, a few hundred, without proper equipment. And we just don't have it. It's criminal, actually. When I was Lieutenant Governor, I had the opportunity of going over to Cyprus, where, for, you're probably aware of this, for 29 years, the Canadians had a regiment in Cyprus, and they'd rotate them every year, so I think it was every year. Anyway, I was Colonel in Chief of a regiment here, the Rocky Mountain Rangers up in Kamloops, which is an honorary position, by the way. I jumped from major to honor full colonel, and overnight. Anyway, I had the opportunity to go to Cyprus because the regiment on duty there at that time was the 3rd Battalion of the Patricias, and I'm an honorary Patricia. You'll see my certificate here, signed by Lady Mountbatten, who was our Colonel-in-Chief. And so my wife and I went to Cyprus, and remember, this was a regular force, 3rd Battalion, PPCLI, Patricians. But at that time, about 20% of the boys, because there were no girls in those days, this was in the late 80s, I guess, about 20% of the troops there were non-permanent, they were reserves. 5 of them were from my own regiment, the Rocky Mountain Rangers, who were kids. About 6 months before, had been on the streets of Kamloops. They were a member of the reserves, and they're still doing it. I think they're up to 50% of these boys. You'll hear them that went over to Afghanistan. Always, your 50% of them are from the reserves, who are signed up for the period of the tour, and they have not been fully trained. I mean, we're doing the same thing we swore would never allow to happen. We're sending untrained young men, and now women, in their situations where they're not properly trained or equipped for. I mean, that's the tragedy of it. And the politicians keep always saying, 100 here and 1,000 there. But the public doesn't generally know, I don't know if you're aware of that, that they're not a regular force. We have the Van Dues, which are a first-class French regiment, and we have the Royal Regiment, and we have the 11th Hussars, which are the tank regiment in New Brunswick. And who else we got? We got the Royal Regiment. We've got two infantry regiments and a tank regiment and support troops, of course. We got artillery. But when these overseas assignments for peacekeeping or whatever they call it, they're from the reserves. They're volunteers. They're all volunteers, mind you. And they do it for the excitement or the money or both or whatever. But it's a sad state of affairs we're in. In fact, came out the other day, who killed the Canadian military by who's the author of the
I'm not sure. I actually just saw that book as well.
What's that?
I actually just saw it at a bookstore.
Yeah, I have a copy somewhere. I just think, anyway, and of course he blames it right on the politicians from Mr. Trudeau on down. Mm-hmm. And then of course he ends up by saying it's you and I, it's the general public who allow this situation to develop. The budget today is about equivalent to what we give to our First Nations people, I think it is. Not too far different. And our priorities are somewhat a little screwed up. So, how are we doing now? Anything else? Any other areas that I haven't touched on?
If you're willing, comment a bit on morale.
I think my wife told me to take my pills, excuse me.
If you could comment a bit on morale, specifically on the visits that Montgomery had to your regiment, how they affected morale.
Well, I had the pleasure of meeting Montgomery only once. Of course, we saw a lot of him on the news and in the papers. When he came back to Britain to take over the Southeast Command, and he was designated, of course, for the planning of D-Day, he came down to visit the Canadian Army, and we had lots of advance warning, and of course, for days and weeks, I guess, we polished all our tanks, and we polished our boots, and we polished our canvas, that we call them. And so when the general arrived, we were all lined up, all the tanks lined up, and we were all spit and polished. And we expected the normal inspection, marching up and down. Typical Montgomery, he didn't. He took one one squadron at a time, I guess, and said, "Now, okay, everybody come around. You've probably seen him. He's famous for this." He wanted to make, we thought we were going to get a speech. So he did. He told us how fortunate we were that we were going to be the spearhead of the heart of France and Germany. And then, to the surprise and astonishment of most of us, because we were all with our heavy packs on, don't ask me why, because tank men never went into battle with packs on their backs. But all the officers were lined up, and they say, "Now, all the senior officers line up here," so they would. And they say, "Now, you see that tree over, and this is the other side of the field. Now, when I say go, I want you to run as fast as you can and run back again." This is not unique to our regiment, by the way. And our commanding officer at that time was an old man of 45, I guess, who had been an RCM, NPLM, not a reserve officer, as most of our senior officers had. So they were mostly in their 30s, I'd say, or some in their 40s. Well, you can guess what happened. Remember, they had full pack on. They probably hadn't marched 2 miles in the last 6 months, because we were sitting on our ass in a jeep or a tank most of the time. Well, needless to say, we never got all the details, but it was amazing how many of our senior officers were suddenly retired or sent back to Canada to train as training officers. Of course, it's the best thing that happened to us, because they were fine people, but they were not physically. A man of 45, you know, you wouldn't tell him to run and jump into that tank in a hurry. He'd get in, but it wouldn't be as easy as a lad of 21 or 22. You'd be able to scramble up that like nothing. But, and then it turned out that when we went into France, our CO was a fine man, but again, he was one that hadn't been weeded out. I don't mind mentioning name, but on Ray Caldwell from Halifax Fusiliers. And I was the adjutant, so I was very close to him. And the poor man, I mean, he was a man, he was overweight to start with. He had trouble literally getting inside a tank, because he had a punch on him. Well, fortunately, he did land on D-Day, and he made it. But he had trouble with the liquor and so on later on, because that was a problem as well as an opportunity. And fortunately, he was relieved. He didn't get killed, but he was relieved of duty. But these were some of the problems that you're sitting there in England, way on courses, or now the infantry, or that suddenly decide we're not in good physical shape, so you'd be designated to go on a battle school course. You've probably heard of them. Well, I went on the battle school course, and I'd been adjutant, remember, and I was sitting at a desk most of the time, or in a jeep, and I almost got myself killed in the battle course. Because again, you put on full heavy gear, 60 or 70 pounds, whatever it was, plus a rifle, which I'd never carried in my life. And then you'd go on the route marches for miles. The first thing you break down would be your feet. And a lot of them would then end up in the hospital. My own experience, which I'm not proud of, we were being trained to crawl all on our belly and working yourself over between barbed wire and under barbed wire. You've seen pictures of it, I guess, training. And there'd be live ammunition shooting either side, so you had to stay in your line. And periodically, the engineers were there, would blow up in front of you. Well, I'm crawling along like this, keeping my nose down, my head in the mud, and my rifle out in front. And some over-enthusiastic young engineering officer set off a blast right in front of us. Well, it blew the rifle out of my hands. I ended up in hospital, and I'm still deaf in this left ear. I never did get my hearing back. I went back from hospital. I got back to my regiment. But my point is, the training was out of whack. For instance, our dispatch riders who lived on a motorcycle, we had more casualties from them because they'd go on a long route march in a battle school. And I mean, they hadn't walked 10 feet, they're never off their motorcycle. and I hope it doesn't go on today, but I was very critical, and we all were, of some of the training methods and so on. And Montgomery's was crude, but I guess it proved his point that at certain stages we were not in good shape. Now today, as I understand it, the military are in good shape. I hope it's so. I don't know, really. But that was a physical training, and good physical condition was very important, and it is today.
Great.
Okay, anything else?
No, that's good.
Yeah.